want to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Kill us if he got the chance.
I can handle things, I'm smart!
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Hello and welcome back to the Quadfecta, the podcast where we're talking about history's great filmmakers and whether they were able to accomplish four truly great films in a row. I'm John Engel.
And I'm Mitch Bryan.
And today we are going to discuss the works of Hayao Miyazaki. And today we have a couple of Miyazaki experts on the show. We have from the upcoming podcast...
Yes.
It hasn't aired yet, has it? Okay.
No.
The upcoming podcast, Science and Magic, the Films of Studio Ghibli, we have Jamie Anderson and Neil Brown. Hey, guys.
Hello.
How are we doing?
Hi.
Doing well.
Thank you for joining us. So how far away are we from your show dropping?
Don't know. What do you think, Jamie? We've recorded 12 episodes. There are 22 movies, so we're probably not far off for having enough in the bank to take the stress out of the remaining recordings. So I guess probably maybe in a month or two once we get some more editing done and such.
Yeah.
Excellent. So who knows, but that sounds great.
Don't underestimate the excitement of the shrinking cushion of episodes, too. It's always fun to get down to the, oh, no, if we don't record an episode this week, we're going to miss our schedule.
Yep. I mean,
I'm
it's
sure
real,
you'll get there, though.
It's a very indulgent project on our part, and we don't really even know how frequently we're going to release the episodes. Every couple of weeks, maybe it's a 3 week. It doesn't really kind of matter. It's just really, for fun for us, and if anyone happens to want to listen along, then that'd be great.
Has HBO Max International made available all the Studio Ghibli films the way that they have done here in the States?
In the UK, where I am, they're all on Netflix.
Oh, they're on Netflix.
Yeah,
right.
And we get the Japanese language original, and we get the Disney dubs, which I'm sure we'll come to talk about, a bunch of other language dubs as well. One of my favorites of those being the French version of Porco Rosso, which has Jean Reno as the titular Porco, which is great.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Which
that
Miyazaki,
makes me want to watch it again now.
You should. It's great. He's better than Michael Keaton, I think.
Yeah.
I think Miyazaki prefers that version as well.
Probably.
He says that's his actually one of the few films where he prefers a separate language version of his own film.
Interesting. I don't understand why they're not on Disney Plus. But who knows?
The deal
you guys don't
out.
Have to know.
the deal has run out. They did a 15-year deal back in end of the 90s. I mean, Mononoke was the first one to be released after that deal. And some great stories around that, which I'm sure we'll come to talk to. But that's the end of that deal. So I think they've lost the rights now.
Gotcha.
Yeah, Time Warner scooped him up, I believe. That's why they're on HBO Max.
Mm. Disney will probably buy them soon.
I don't know. The one competitor Disney has as far as size, and quantity of companies that's swallowing up is Time Warner. They're the one that they're like, it's going to be the 1-2 punch of those two sometime in the future, I think.
Yeah.
Michael Crichton had it right all those years ago when he was writing about how there was going to eventually just be five corporations in the world. And it's starting to look like that.
Yeah.
Yep. Isn't that how Rollerball, the movie, is as well? It's just one corporation in each city.
Well, as long as the
corporate rewards.
As long as the fashion goes in that direction, I'll be fine with that.
He's not shooting trees. That's beyond the pale.
Yeah, and Tokyo's going to have an awesome rollerball team,
yes,
as always. So, John, do we want to just jump into the first of these four movies, not in order, so we can play that little game?
Yeah, we're going to play the shuffling films game. This will be the first movie we talk about. It won't necessarily be the first in chronological order, and that is 1997's Princess Mononoke.
When gods walk the earth, an epic battle rages between the encroaching civilization of man and the gods of the forest.
When the forest has been cleared and the wolves wiped out, this place will be the richest land in the world.
Now, the fate of the world rests on the courage of one fearless princess.
I'm not afraid to die, and I would do anything to get the humans out of here.
and one brave warrior.
You fight like a demon, boy. Like something possessed.
What exactly are you here for?
To see with eyes unclouded by hate.
Now watch closely, everyone. I'm going to show you how to kill a god. Fire!
Gillian Anderson, Billy Crudup, Claire Danes, Minnie Driver, Jada Pinkett Smith, and Billy Bob Thornton.
You cannot alter your fate, however. You can rise to meet it if you choose.
Princess Mononoke.
Okay, it was the first in the Disney deal. So it was imported into the United States by the Weinstein Group, I believe, actually, initially, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And there's one of my favorite ever movie stories is Miyazaki dealing with Harvey Weinstein. And so much more satisfying now than it even was the first time I heard it.
Yeah.
That's incidentally the first and only Studio Ghibli film I saw in first release in the theaters.
Really?
Wow, what a want to have.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's I have my favorite, and I have the one that I think is the best, and they're not the same movie. This one is the one that I think is the best, and it just tips another one we're going to talk about, but this is, I think, his masterpiece, Mononoke.
This is my favorite one too.
Yeah,
though not the best.
Oh, you have it a different way, right?
I have it flopped. I think I know which movie you're talking about, Neil, but
favorite one, and I don't think it's the best either. But it's truly great. I mean, I'm going to say that right up front.
Right.
There's no way around it. It has the one little flaw to me. We can get into it shortly, Neil. I didn't mean to interrupt you. It seemed like you were about to say something.
I was actually just going to say there's a great, you know, talking about the Weinstein stuff. There's a great book that I have right here by Steve Alpert, who used to work at Studio Ghibli. It's called The Sharing a House with the Neverending Man. And he worked there. He was the only gaijin to work there in a kind of senior role. And he was around at that time. So he was brought along to the US along with Toshio Suzuki, the great producer. It was he and Suzuki that delivered the famous prop katana with no blade. You know, it was a dull blade. It was a movie prop. Looked exactly real because, of course, they wanted to reduce the length of this movie. Perhaps, in my mind, perhaps the only flaw of this movie is it's long. Of course, Weinstein wanted to cut the movie, and they delivered this dull katana with no cuts written across the blade. And it was quite emphatic in its message, I think.
Yeah, I love that story. And I believe at a later date, Miyazaki was asked about the story, and he just said, "Yes, I defeated him." And that was all. That was his only comment about that.
So Harvey did back down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was released in full length.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know how many other times he has kowtowed to a director. Like, he was so notorious for just almost doing it out of spite, you know, like, I'm going to have my cut no matter what, even if it's just one or two cuts, or amping up the music, or whatever.
Or not releasing it at all, just out of spite. It was a Weinstein thing that he had done a couple of times as well. Maybe more of those directors should have presented weapons to him. Maybe that was the key.
Because he's just a big coward in the end, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, what the things that I love so much about this movie, I mean, you know, I could just go on all day about it, really. But I mean, to try and kind of narrow it down a bit, for me, you know, having watched through his movies for our podcast, I mean, I'd seen kind of these movies before, but, you know, to really watch them in a studious way for our podcast, and we're doing them in release order, so we're kind of working through Miyazaki's oeuvre, and getting to this one, I really appreciate the scale of this movie. It is a really big it really packs a punch, this movie. It's not super tight like some of his other movies. It's a bit gratuitous in some of his pacing, but he what I like about his pacing in this movie is he gives you action, and it's brutal kind of action. It's quite relentless sometimes, but then he gives the audience a bit of a break just for a minute or two, and then it's straight back in the action again. So you might think that those few minutes are indulgent, rightly or wrongly. I don't know, really. That's a judgment call, I guess, or a matter of opinion. I like them because I think it just gives me a little kind of chance to take a bit of a rest, and then it's bang, it's back into the action.
Yeah.
It moves effortlessly between genres, too. Like, it starts out as this Jambara samurai movie, and then it becomes this fantasy, and, I mean, it just fascinates me that the way that it incorporates different genres and makes them all feel wedded properly.
It also really feels like when you watch the movies that came before it, like, it's like those movies were a rehearsal for what Princess Mononoke was. Like, you can see elements of his previous work that were less good in the previous movies building up to things. Like, the beginning of Mononoke has this chase scene that's really similar to the beginning of Nausicaa, for example, but it's like just a little bit better in Mononoke.
Yeah, the quality of, I don't know enough about animation. I worried a little bit about doing this episode because I don't know enough about animation maybe to talk the talk. But this movie has a kineticism to it that he hadn't quite accomplished yet in other films, where the movement was truly like visceral and impactful. And maybe Porco Rosso with the aerial sequences, but these were not aerial sequences. We're talking about on the ground. There's the one shot of Ashitaka swimming through the water, just like right at the camera, and it's really like kind of punches you a little bit, and it's a real quick cut. And the way the score is another thing that's vastly improved the way. But I mean, some of the scores of these movies are a little kitschy, a little
a lot of synthy,
and not this kind of synthy that we like, maybe like the kind of synthy that you heard in an elevator in 1987, you know. But this one has like the full on score to match the action and the images you're seeing. And it's an impressive, like you said, Nausicaa's great. And Nausicaa has a lot of great stuff, but it's really rough around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
And Porco Rosso, like I said, has the aerial sequences, but I imagine they're a little bit easier to accomplish than these, like the running gazelles or horses or people. And I think this is extremely impressive bit of animation. Massive amount of animation.
and it was the last one that all of the animation cells were hand painted onto screens. There was no digital animation in this. Later on, they would hand paint everything, and then they would put that onto a digital platform and cut the movie that way. But this was actually made in the old traditional way, on, I don't know what you call them. I guess this is clear plastic film.
Plastic cells.
Cell animation.
Yeah.
So because this was part of that Disney deal, does that mean there was no lag between production and release in the United States?
Well, I don't think that it was made under the Disney deal. It was
no, but they put money into it.
I don't think initially. I think they just imported it. Now, you guys might be able to correct me on this. I think this one was just imported in on the Disney deal, and then after that,
I think that's right.
Yeah.
So was there a lapse between production and when it got to the States?
I think it was a year or two, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, because they had Neil Gaiman write the English script, which he did not start doing until after the movie had come out in Japan, I think. I was 12 when this happened, but I was really into both Neil Gaiman and Gillian Anderson, who plays Moro the Wolf. So I was following all this in, like, what was Empire Magazine, I think, was where I was reading about all of this. I remember there was, like, a time period where the movie was out in Japan, and then they were working on, like, the English version of it, so...
So I just checking the facts. So yeah, April 2000, the English dub was released theatrically in Japan, along with a documentary. It had a limited theatrical release in 2018. I think it was either So it was either 1999 or 2000. It was out in the States. It was 97 released in Mononoke. So you got a year or two in between.
Yeah.
And it was a giant hit. That's another thing we could talk about with this one. And what we do talk about as part of the quadfecta equation is like sometimes the impact, the box office impact can help it a little bit. In this case, he hadn't had big hits yet. He'd done well with his other films. This one knocked E.T. off the top of the list in Japan its first run, which quite impressive. We had 15 years of E.T. sitting on top of the heap there, and it came right along and knocked it right down. I think it got knocked off by Titanic the next year or that year.
Yeah,
I can't remember what year Titanic came out, but still, I mean,
I think.
Imagine, you know, Porco Rosso, Kiki, Nausicaa, none of those, Totoro, none of those touched the box office list in Japan. Mm-hmm. And this one just suddenly is like, this is Star Wars, you know. And I remember hearing that a lot. And when I watch it, I don't understand. I think it was just a marketing thing. But I remember when this movie came out and everybody was going, oh, it's like an anime Star Wars. And I watch it and I'm like, I don't see that, but I guess you're just trying to say that it has this impact and could be this popular, make this big popular splash. I don't know.
Kind of like game changing, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, like Star Wars really changed what movies came after it.
Yeah, I guess that's what they meant.
Yeah.
I don't think they'd seen a movie like this or come across one before. I mean, when it was in production, there were concerns around the samurai setting because they felt that was oversaturated in the market, and they were concerned around the violence that was that's in the movie. It's a pretty violent movie, and so Suzuki, his approach to that is to embrace those elements, and he stuck them both in the trailer. So if you watch the trailer for this, you see arms being lopped off, and you see the samurai sword play and the attacks on the village, right front and center. And he was absolutely right because they lapped it up and they loved it, and it smashed the box office.
This is
as a 12-year-old girl when this came out, it was awesome.
For sure.
An awesome movie. Did you as a 12-year-old girl, what did you think about Lady Eboshi back then?
Oh yeah, I thought she was great, but mostly I loved the Wolf Princess.
Yeah.
Who, she's not called Mononoke in the movie. She's called San. That right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was super into her.
She's the heart of she's the heart and soul of the movie.
Yeah.
Which I think, which leads me to my one flaw that I mentioned earlier, which is Ashitaka is not the heart and soul of this movie. Had the movie hung on him, we would have had a real problem.
Yeah.
Because he's too heroic. I mean, annoyingly earnest at times.
He's very, very Mary Sue.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, we've got to assume, given the female characters, strong female characters that appear through so many of his movies, that he knew what he was up to. He knew that this was that this was going to be a nominal hero, and we were going to find out very quickly that the other characters were really the ones that we were interested in and who are making things happen.
Mm-hmm.
He's like the conflict resolver. He's a bit of a like negotiator, right? Where the exciting, interesting, emotional stuff is happening on the two other ends. Mm-hmm. He's the one that's constantly trying to pull the thread tighter and get everybody on the same page, which is a good function as a character, but it's not something you want to hang your movie on, like as far as actually being your protagonist. And he's just like, there's times, and maybe it's the Billy Crudup's English dub acting, where I just like roll my eyes. Yeah. Like, where I'm like, the one time where he's helping the women on the bellow, and he's like, it's real hard work, isn't it? And I'm like, geez, dude. It sounds like he's just kissing their ass, kind of, you know, like, I'm a real understanding guy, aren't I? It's like, have a flaw, please. Come on.
This is one where the Disney dubs generally don't work for me. There is a notable exception that we'll come to, but this one is one of the worst ones, I think, and it takes me right out of the movie, to be honest. It's set in Japan. It should be watched in Japanese language, I think. And that's really when you listen to the Japanese original, you know, the voice work they do, and the kind of post-production work they do on the voices is fantastic, especially of course for the kami, the gods, you know, Moro, the wolf mother, you know, her voice is growling, it's almost a masculine voice. In fact, I think it's a man that provides the voice, but it's definitely a step change. This one is more than the others. The Disney dub is, it fails for me.
I'm going to stick up for Claire Danes as Son.
Yeah, she does. I think she does okay, and I think Gillian Anderson does a good job.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
And I think Keith David's voice is always welcome.
Maro gets to say my favorite line, which is, I actually wrote it down, which is, I was hoping you'd cry out in your sleep so I could bite off your head to silence you. It's a great line.
This doesn't fall any punches, this movie.
No.
This is not for kids. About these...
actually think, like, the Neil Gaiman script is really good, the English script. It has some really iconic lines, I think.
And they're not... See, here's the thing, is where I'm not... I haven't seen most of these in Japanese. I've seen them almost all in the dub version. So I don't know how many differences are there. Are there added lines to that? I've always been curious about this because my theory, which is completely uneducated theory, it's just a guess, is that the reason why dubbed anime has the kind of humorous, fast-talking is because people are trying to jam the original line in a place where in English it takes a lot more to say it.
Yeah.
And I've always just assumed that's the case. But do they go in and change the dialogue considerably when they do the English? Like, did Gaiman change the dialogue a bit here and there and add lines or take some away?
My understanding is that he did more than most. Okay. And that was part of this being, like, the first one to be released in the U.S. is they wanted, like, a script written by, you know, a professional writer, not just a translator.
Right.
But I don't think the other ones, Neil, you probably know more about this than I do, but I don't think the other ones had, like, a specific script writer come in. I think it was more of a translation thing.
Some of them do. I mean, when we get into the ones where John Lasseter starts to pick them up, and that's basically Spirited Away and onwards, he brings in his own script writers to produce the Disney dub. But they take a somewhat different approach, and they change lines to fit the mouth movements rather than and in some ways lose context or change the way that you kind of think about a character because of the line change, and that's that I don't agree with. There's some great examples of that in Spirited Away. But this one, I think, you know, Gaiman is a good choice because he's kind of the same. He's a fantasy writer, isn't he? So he's I think he's a good choice, and he's quite a good writer, I think. So,
Yeah, and that definitely is the exception, not the rule, because even that approach to trying to fit the dialogue to, you know, match the mouth movements, that was the old trick too with a lot of live action movies, Italian spaghetti westerns. You can tell the good ones from the bad ones because there's somebody trying to make that part of it convincing. Now the dialogue is still probably terrible, but they've stripped it down and reduced it to where it fits the lips. So I think that the fact that there's actual care being taken on these dubs, no matter how successful or unsuccessful it is, they're at least hiring real actors to come in and do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's a cut above what usually happens.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, you'll see the cast list for the Disney dub, like this one, it's got a few stars, and, you know, when we get to kind of Howl's Moving Castle, it's got big stars in it. And then some, like Spirited Away, not so much. And you've got some actual kind of voice actors in there. And I think that's nice too, right? Because, I mean, they're the real kind of talent in this kind of sphere, right? And actually, when you get those ones, that's when it's a slightly better performance, I think, because that's their day job.
Well, should we just move on to talking about Spirited Away then? I think we could use that as a little segue.
That's a perfect transition. Well,
yeah, perfect.
Done.
Yeah, when you say it out loud, that's the perfect segue. Always the spoken segue.
Walt Disney Studios presents a Studio Ghibli film.
Honey, don't take a shortcut. You always get us lost.
From master filmmaker Hayao Miyazaki.
What is it?
Come on, let's go in. I want to see what's on the other side.
Where are you going? Hey!
be here. Get out of here now!
What?
Leave before it gets dark. You've got to get across the river. Go! I'll distract them. Don't be afraid. I'm Master Haku.
No!
I just want to help you.
No!
In worlds seen and unseen, where spirits are transformed, and sorcerers rule.
The witch Ibaba controls you by stealing your name. If you completely forget it, you'll never find your way home.
Your name belongs to me now.
One girl's future depends on her judgment.
Aren't you getting wet out there? I'll leave the door open for you.
Her courage.
It's Haku! He's hurt! Haku! Haku! This way!
Her loyalty.
Haku helped me before. Now I want to help him. Everyone, I need my shoes and clothes, please.
And remembering one thing above all else.
I want you to know my real name. It's Chihiro.
Walt Disney Studios presents a Studio Ghibli film. Experience a magical movie phenomenon. Embraced by all the world.
Let's go!
This fall, prepare to be spirited away.
So Spirited Away, this is my favorite, and I think the best. I think it's both things to me. And I never, ever get tired of this movie. And it, something about it, like as soon as it starts, I get like fluttery. It's weird. It's like one of the great, I think it might be the greatest animated film ever made, in my opinion. And we could talk more about other animators and other animation history a little bit at some point. But this one really gets me. What do you guys, where's it at? Is it anyone's also thinks it's the best? Because we were talking about best and favorite.
I think it's the best one as a film. I just like the story of Mononoke more. Yeah. So.
I think it's, you could argue easily that it's his best work. I mean, it's such a tight movie. There's no fat in this movie whatsoever. It's just it's full pace all the way through, barely lets up. It's Back to the Future levels of like here's something, you know, in the first 10 minutes of the movie that in an hour's time will be important. You know, and, it's all from his own. It's all from his own brain. There's no source material. He wrote this movie just as he did with Mononoke. Howells has source materials from a book and a few of his others are Kiki's Delivery Services from a book. The rest are pretty much from his own mind. And that's kind of where I think this and Mononoke kind of step up, because this is real original work. And actually, I've got a question for you guys because this is where your expertise comes in far more than mine. And it's, you know, when I look at Miyazaki's work, I kind of look and think, well, what a fantastic first of all artist. You know, he's an artist in his own right. He's got his own definite style, and then, you know, the movies that he makes, I like to watch, and I put him on as there's a good director. But that's where I kind of my expertise is not the strong. Do you guys think he's a good director of a movie? Does he write good movies? And that's where I kind of lack the expertise.
Mitch, you want to take that one first?
Yeah, I'm just stunned at what kind of a director he is, and that he's working, even though he's this amazing animator and he can do anything that he wants to with animation, he always demonstrates to me this incredible sense of control and knowing when to deliver something special and then when to kind of pull back. And I don't think he's ever mundane, but I think he understands that the ebb and flow of emotions and how when you have to settle things down, it may mean it's a simple shot, but like his camera movements are also organic to the story as far as I go. You know, I never feel like he's one of those directors where when he's really showy, the showiness is always so logical. You know, so you're like, oh man, that's really amazing, and then your brain goes, and that's exactly how it would look. Right. That's exactly how it would happen. You know, it's like he doesn't. I can't think of many instances where I feel like he goes off into some place where my brain can't follow. I don't know if that makes
any
sense.
And yet, as far as his writing, he goes places you would never expect. I mean, it's
never
just...
Never expect.
Especially in this movie. To me, this is one of the joys of Spirited Away, to me, is that it seems like it's kind of doing left turns all the time. And you're going in this sort of serpentine way through the story in that sense, because you think it's going one way, and then they introduce a thing that makes perfect sense, like you're saying, Mitch. It makes perfect sense for the world that we're in and the movie we're seeing, but you have no idea, like, how did he come up with the... You know, it's a stink spirit. It shows up when the big event of this sequence is going to be pulling a bicycle out of, it's just, to me, great scenes.
There's a great moment when we get to the last one in our list, and I will mention it when we get there, about how he unexpectedly works the suspense machine. And right. I'll wait till we get there, but we'll talk about that too.
Do you think he has a good kind of eye for a shot?
Oh yeah!
Oh yeah! Yeah, I think yeah.
He knows.
Don't
how,
you?
He knows. No, I do. I mean, I I'm kind of a fanboy of these movies, but so I, you know, was just very keen to during this recording to get your views on exactly kind of more technical movie making angle. But no, I totally agree.
I love when he decides not to have music. Like that's for me. That's always the hallmark of a great filmmaker, is knowing when they don't need music and when they can just let this thing happen. And he's, you know, because I always think about animation as often wall-to-wall music and not being willing to accept silences. And I know that that's one of the things, like in the Batman animated series that we worked on, those directors were always really encouraged to use sound to its full potential, which means silence, which means stripping things away. And I think that Miyazaki does that. He makes these amazing choices about when the music isn't there.
Yeah, he does. There's a great example of that at the end of Kiki's Delivery Service, right after she saved Tombo from the Zeppelin, and you see that sequence. In fact, there's about a minute and a half of just silence. There's no music, and you would think many directors would think, right, I need a big sweeping kind of dramatic score piece here, and it's a very interesting choice. It works beautifully.
That's the other question I would throw back in your direction, which is there is such sweep to his movies, and you said scale earlier, and I like what for you is the Miyazaki sweep? What would that be? What is the thing that you kind of always expect and feel is part of him?
Well, I guess there's a few things for me. I mean, what is the sheer... The imagination of the man, and it's the unexpected, as we kind of touched on earlier. But I think for me, you know, the one thing he's really great at is kind of the opposite of what Disney does. And he introduces ambiguity to a great degree in his movies. I mean, just go back to that last movie we talked about, Lady Eboshi. Is she a goodie or is she a baddie? It gets you asking questions. It's not straightforward. It's not linear. It just gets you scratching your head, and that's what keeps you coming back, I think.
I think it's, you know, really cool how there's all these, like, if you understand any, like, a little bit about Japanese folklore, you can see these characters and know who they are, but they also work perfectly without that context. So it's like an added depth to his films, which, like, in Spirited Away, I think is particularly cool.
There's an aspect to a specific type of character that Miyazaki presents us multiple times throughout his career that I wanted to ask you guys about, because maybe you know more. Maybe this discussion goes on in the world of the Miyazaki fan that I'm not a part of at this point. But this was particularly about the character Lin, who was her sort of antagonist at the beginning and then ally as the film goes on. And that is, I believe the last person we talked about in the Quadfecta was Howard Hawks. And there's this idea of the Hawksian woman that's always talked about, specifically through his screwball comedies of the 30s and so forth. And Lynn strikes me, and tell me if this is a thing, as the like Miyazakian woman. There's a certain type of woman, and that never the lead, and never necessarily, and usually an ally of some kind. And they're similar. Like Kiki's, I'm forgetting the character's name in Kiki right now, but her friend in Kiki is similar. The baker, the but the painter.
Ursula.
Yeah. Ursula, yeah.
And Milady and Princess Mononoke, even though she's a much heavier character and more fleshed out in a lot of ways. Is this something that I'm just making up in my head, or is this something... I don't know how to even describe it. There's a similarity between them all. They're all brunette. They're all sort of tall. They're all, you know, and when they do the English voice casting, it's typically pretty similar, which there I will fail to describe what the similar voice is exactly, but it makes sense to me. Does this make sense to you guys at all?
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I feel like they're sort of like mentor figures to the young girls who are often the protagonists of the film, you know, because the other like obvious mentors would be like their mothers or more motherly characters, but a lot of the girls are choosing paths that might not lead to like a traditional life. So I feel like you need that kind of mentor figure to show you another way to grow up.
Sure. I mean, it's a thing he likes to do in his writing, isn't it? Because quite often he takes his main protagonists away from their family. And Herx is normally a girl, her kind of safety net, right? And, and puts her in a situation. I mean, in Porco Rosso, you have Fio, who's taken away from her grandfather, and she goes off on the adventure with Porco, and that's kind of her development arc, I guess, is how she grows. I mean, Fio doesn't have a huge arc in that movie. Obviously, Chihiro does in Spirited Away. And in fact, the whole movie really is about her arc and how she grows and develops from the brat that she is at the start in the car to, you know, the respectful, grateful and thoughtful person that she is at the end.
I feel like because Fio's older, Fio's like 18. She is like sort of in the transition period between like the younger teen protagonist and the Miyazaki woman that we were just discussing, which is why she's like so good at dealing with the pirates. You know, she's started to become that kind of tougher lady that she will be later in life.
Well, I mean, liminality is in almost all of his movies, and he really just likes this phasing from an adult to from a child to an adult, and he presents it in various parts of that kind of process. And Kiki's right at the start of that process. She's just kind of gone through puberty. She's in a witch's world. That's when they leave home. And Fio's kind of a bit more towards the end of that journey, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I think he builds that kind of liminality with this genre thing, too, that he's always doing. By taking these opposing genres and putting them together, he can exist kind of in between the genres. And I think this movie, Spirited Away, is on one hand a clear tip of the hat to... you know, the tradition of the Japanese ghost story movie like Kwaidan. And then it also is, it seems to me to be acknowledging the way that animation has allowed the fantasy film to move into the more grotesque representations. Certainly the multi-armed guy, you know, is so scary and so real all at the same time. And I just think that that's, it reminded me of things that I had seen in earlier mangas and even in unsuccessful live action Japanese horror attempts. You know, you can't, there's just no way to do that, guy. But boy, when you can do it with animation, it's amazing.
We were particularly upset by the big baby during our Spirited Away episode, which I feel like would also be really tough to do not in an animated film, but is horribly grotesque in this film.
Maybe Terry Gilliam in his prime.
Yeah, exactly.
Manage that, and that's about it. You know, speaking of genre, to me, there's a Disney, there's a bit of Disney to this outside of the literal distribution and so forth. And that this movie reminds me of a little Pinocchio in the sense of animation genres, where it's child is thrust into this sort of fantasy adventure.
Terrifying
sinister, fantasy adventure.
Yeah. Yes. Pinocchio's a scary movie.
Transformational. Oh, yeah, it's my favorite of, it's also my favorite of the old original Disney's.
I really liked it too. I haven't seen it in many years, but it was one of my favorites as a kid.
Yeah, we watched
Dumbo
it.
Is similar, and Dumbo is much too scary.
Wow, really?
Oh my gosh. The scene where Dumbo is drunk is like haunting childhood nightmares.
Goodness.
I remember that was the one that was always talked about as the, I can't believe they did that to children.
Yeah.
The pink elephants and all of that. That's terrible. I just remember hearing that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Of course, I've been catching, being a father for the last 8-9 years now, I've been catching up on all this stuff. So I saw a lot of those old Disneys and the re-releases that happened in the late 70s and early 80s. They would do like one re-release a year is kind of what I remember. And
Going to say you're catching hell for what you're showing to your kid.
No, but I do. I will say with the parental eye, you know, we watch Pinocchio and I'm like, those kids are smoking cigars. I'm not so sure about this. Of course, it doesn't really matter. He's not actually going to go start smoking cigars. And the same with Princess Mononoke. Well. You know, Princess Mononoke is the one Miyazaki movie where I go, you know, when I showed it to Archer the first time when he was 4 or 5,
oh,
I was like, maybe I shouldn't have done this, but he's a sophisticated kid. So, but this one, you know, we love this one. We watch this one all the time and, Spirited Away. And, it's like I said, genre wise, it reminds me of Pinocchio. The Japanese ghost story element is there, Mitch, like
and
you said,
the Odyssey
and the Odyssey,
well.
Of course,
the hero's journey.
And yet,
Alice
with
in
all
Wonderland
those
too.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yep. Yep.
So we're talking about all these seminal, iconic story structures that people use every day when they're writing, and yet this movie never quite fits the story structures that we're talking about. It's always, again, he always surprises us because he doesn't I don't think he cares about that stuff.
No.
I'm not sure. I'm not saying that he doesn't care about writing, but there's a part of him, I think, that's like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Tradition be damned as far as storytelling, which is often true of Japanese storytelling in general, actually, or at least our Western traditions. They don't care that much about
whether
it,
it's
a lot
true
of
or not, because I'm always suspicious of when I read things about filmmakers' processes and everything. But his process is always described as being very organic and not knowing where he's going to wind up necessarily. Hmm. And he hits roadblocks and he works out the problems in the process of making the story. So I don't know. The impression is that he does not set out with a strong outline, that he discovers the films as he moves through them.
This one feels like the most, by this one, I mean Spirited Away, feels like the most like tightly plotted of any of his movies that I have seen so far. All the other ones do have that like wandering quality, I think. Which can sometimes frustrate me, but this one really felt like everything that happened needed to happen at the moment it happened.
Yeah, and it's great because there's the spine, a very rigid spine through the movie, right? Her parents turn to pigs. They're becoming more pig-like all the time, and if the hawk runs out, she'll never know who her parents are anymore, right? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, the things that inform her character and then drive her through the story, the engine of the story, are never exactly what you would need to do. That moment, you know, it's like she needs to get a job. Nobody wants to give her a job, and how she gets a job is bizarre, and I can barely even articulate it. And then she needs to ingratiate herself at her job, and again, coming back to the bath scene, who could ever see that coming, you know?
Right.
And yet those are, you're right, Jamie, those are the things that need to happen for her character to move through the story, to get to her points of discovery, which she needs to get to the end. So you could draw a pretty straight line through the movie, yet it zigs and zags all through around that line in such a glorious way. And it's why I love it so much. One of the reasons. It's beautiful to look at.
And all of the while, you're surrounded by crazy characters and, you know, your duck camis sitting all in a pond, in a bath, and the giant radish monster in the lift.
Yeah, the radish
it's just
thing is amazing.
Constantly,
I love the ducks. They're so cute.
Constantly throws weird things at you. It's really just a wonderful. It's a wonderful movie. It's a master animator in his prime.
Does he have a thing for pigs, or is this just a coincidence that we have some prominent pigs?
He has a thing for pigs, I believe.
He does. A lot of his early...
It's kind of a trademark.
Is this the transition?
Yeah, sure.
I thought you were...
I had another transition ready to go.
I did that for you. I wanted you to spot that transition.
I had another transition about, Mitch, about your storytelling, your Miyazaki approach to storytelling, because Porco Rosso, which is the next film that we're going to talk about, from what I understand, follows a very... You know, you're talking about his organic way of going into a story and not knowing where he's going to end up. Well, the Porco Rosso was supposed to be a 45 minute long movie, and he just kept making it longer, you know, and it never feels like, I read that story, I was like, well, it never felt like that to me. It feels
it was perfect
the way it is.
Commissioned by Japan Airlines to be the in-flight movie for a domestic flight, so 45 minutes you know, up and down. And he just got started on it and just thought, you know what, it's bigger than that. So
yeah,
wow. You have to take that's two amazing. Flights to see it.
Yeah, right.
People just go back.
Yeah,
like, gotta finish this movie. The second half until you come back. So, let me ask you this: is it the only one of his movies that's situated in a what we could call an historical period?
Princess Mononoke is.
So is Kiki, really, but Kiki is kind of a. Well,
I don't know what
different
Kiki,
take.
You can prove that one to me.
Yeah. Well, no, it is. It's a different. It's an alternate history, but it is supposed to be a specific place.
Totoro is also specifically set in the 50s. In
Grave of the Fireflies isn't him. Sorry, I always forget it's not him.
He would never do that to us.
It was an Totoro is an ambiguous period, but it's generally accepted to be the 50s, kind of pre-TV, is what Miyazaki said.
Mm.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
And Princess Mononoke is like the Muromachi period.
Yeah. Which is shrouded in mystery and, I mean, these ancient periods, right? Whereas this is like so specific to like it's in between. It's before the rise of fascism and after the First World War.
Yeah.
It's very specific.
That's true. And it is very specific.
Mm-hmm. It introduces a great kind of looming threat, doesn't it, of the fascist uprising. I mean, by this time, you know, Mussolini was in power when the movie is set. So, and that's kind of coming up, and you can really it's palpable in the movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it has something that feels very specific and not like his other things. I don't know why, but. Could be just it's a pig flying around the airplane that throws me off, but
well,
the setting is a little unusual.
I guess this will get us into his, we talked about his pig obsession, or however you want to put it, but now we're really getting to his aeronautical obsession.
Oh, yeah. That's Porco the Rosso, true right? obsession.
Which is the true obsession, and I think would place it very specifically. Like, I think while he's interested in these fantastical elements of other worlds and ghost stories and ancient historical ideas, or ancient, maybe it's not the word, but like Princess Mononoke, here is where he would get very specific, is with, he loves these specific airplanes. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm going to make these airplanes that are from this time where I first became fascinated with airplanes. And that would kind of force his hand into, I mean, he could have made this in a fantasy world more, but I think that would kind of force his hand to be more specific about time period, because he wants to, and The Wind Rises, is another one that's clearly is in a very specific historical context, but in a much more dry sort of way than this one. But I think that's it. I think maybe had he decided to be more whimsical with the aeronautical representations, it might have been more of a fantasy film. But I think he needed to be specific with this one.
He shares that obsession with Spielberg. Both of them, who are close to each other, close to the same age. I think. Was Spielberg 44, born in 44? I can't remember, but...
I think he's younger
Miyazaki's
than that,
born in 41, and so they're both obsessed with... It's interesting, the two of them as counterpoints, you know, they're obsessed with many of the same things.
Extremely hard not to think of that scene in Empire of the Sun when young Christian Bale meets the Japanese Zero pilot that's the same age as him. He immediately brought that image to my mind. I'm like, yep, there's two sides of it. Of the two different sides of the same coin, in a way, but I do think Spielberg's a little younger. Wasn't he born in 48 or 49? Anyway, we don't have to get into that.
I'll look. I have the internet, so I'll check.
Well, I thought when he directed the Columbo episode, he was only 21. And that was in 1970.
1946 is Spielberg.
46, okay.
Porco Rosso, Miyazaki's soaring action adventure of a valiant pilot.
Here we go. It is Porco.
Transformed by a mysterious spell.
I only look out for myself.
And his heroic battles to rid the skies of notorious pirates.
Slice them into bacon!
Full of courage and humor.
I'll tell everyone you're chicken!
Chicken, pig, what's the difference?
Take flight with the incredible Porco Rosso.
So this movie, so Porco Rosso is my favorite. As I said earlier, it's not... Okay. It's not the one that I think is his best, but it's just my favorite. I just love it. I think aesthetically it's so beautiful. The setting of the Adriatic Sea and the Dalmatian coast is just, you know, the sweeping shots, the beautiful aeroplane. I mean, you know, Porco's aeroplane is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. There's those sweeping shots where it kind of pans across the sea and we see the beautiful Hotel Adriano. With Gina in a lovely hat, kind of standing outside watching Porco fly by. It's just gorgeous, you know. And for me, it invokes, kind of Casablanca and Ernest Hemingway and Howard Hawks and, you know, people like that. And it's got that kind of just old-timey feel to it.
Yeah, and Terry and the Pirates and Tintin are also kind of evoked by it. Mm-hmm. I love it too. I think it may be my favorite as well.
And I love the ambiguity. You know, we're kind of guessing a bit about what it's all about, what Porco's kind of curse is all about, you know? is it really there? Is it just in his mind? Is it just a bit of post-traumatic stress from the stressful episode that he went through in the First World War with his buddy dies, the husband of Gina. When we see the mask kind of slip momentarily, when Theo kind of watches him, when he's not kind of thinking about anything, maybe that's a kind of relaxed moment where he's just back to normal. So, and then at the end, you know, Miyazaki kind of doesn't really close it out in a nice, neat way. He doesn't show you for sure that he's back to normal. He kind of insinuates a little bit with that kiss at the end from Theo that maybe his mask has dropped and he's back to normal. He doesn't even tell us if him and Gina really get together in the end. It's just all guesswork, but it's beautiful for it.
Yeah, and the Disney version, you would have had the like whirlwind go around him and pick him up into the air a little bit as he transforms into a man again or something. And I like that you don't get that. And I don't know. I mean, there's part of it, the ambiguity of it. There's part of me that just says, hey, he just needed... This is the story of this individualist. So make him as individual as possible. We're in the world of animation. Just make him a pig. And there's more to it than that. I think everything you're saying has merit. But it could just be simply explained that way too, which then that creates the ambiguity, right? You can come up with explanations, but you can also come up with a simple explanation and you just kind of shrug and go, it's just great. It's okay. We don't have to explain it necessarily.
I mean, he said himself, Miyazaki, that the barrier to both entry and exit of Disney films is too low and too wide. And the quote is just that. And then he goes on to say, to me, they show nothing but contempt for the audience. So he's does the exact opposite. Makes it difficult to get in and difficult to get out. But going through that journey is what it's all about. And that really is the buy-in. You know, you've got to kind of get into it. You've got to pay attention to what's going on. I wouldn't want it any other way.
That's the Eastern Western cliche, but there's always some truth in cliches that Western films want everybody to see exactly the same movie, and Eastern films want to create spaces for everybody to kind of have their own experience with the film.
Is that Porco Rosso on your TV behind you, Mitch?
It is. Okay. It is Porco Rosso on my TV.
He always does that. He always puts a movie on that we're talking about back there.
So you said that Jean Reno does the voice in the French version, which just sounds amazing, so I have to watch that. Were there other international stars that did voices in other languages? Do you know?
He's the only one that I've come across. In all of the movies, I'm not aware of any of the others having quite a star like that. But it's definitely worth checking out.
Who would be the great German voice for Porco Rosso? At the
crumbs,
Klaus Kinski.
It's too long.
I know, yeah, I'm kidding.
Jürgen Prock.
You're not going to get that psycho into Jürgen Prock voice now. Booth. Yeah, there you go.
I realize he's not German, but now I can't stop hearing like Arnold Schwarzenegger doing a Porco Rosso.
Oh, man.
Oh, that wouldn't be bad.
Could have been interesting. Maybe like later, like now. The aged like Arnold Arnie. Would have been better than the young Arnold.
An old Arnold.
But we should say that Michael Keaton does a good job. In the Disney version.
I thought he did. Yeah.
I think he's fine. Neil, I'm interested in what you think, though, because I've heard that this is one of the more disliked among the anti-English dub people. Yeah.
Is it too clipped? Too glib? What do you think?
It's too mono. It's just too samey all the way through. It's just not enough for me. It's, you know, I get that that's the character a bit, and, you know, he's a bit kind of gruff and grizzly and growly. But sometimes he's not, and sometimes he kind of perks up a bit, and I don't get that from Michael Keaton.
Yeah. Okay, who would be the best British actor?
British
or UK actor? We can include.
We'll put Northern Ireland in there.
I don't know. I'm not good at these questions. I'll come back to me. I'll have a think.
Okay.
It's fun to think about, though. And
no, I love.
You
want
to
like
know
what
who's
the Italian? I like how you analyze. What's that?
Who's the Italian? Is what we should be asking. I mean,
Giancarlo Giannini,
or the Spaniard? Would Banderas have done this one justice? I don't know. A little young at the time.
That's funny. All right.
I don't know,
other thoughts?
Do we have any other thoughts about Porco Rosso? I mean, I'm just gonna shout out one particular action sequence, which is the canal scene, which is really striking. When you get to it, you've had these lovely, you know, the opening action sequence with the pirates and the saving of the girls, which is incredible. You know, we haven't
it's so great.
One movie we haven't mentioned at all is Castle in the Sky, and you kind of get. You get a lot of Castle in the Sky at the beginning of this movie, I think. This idea of pirate fortresses in the sky and children being kidnapped and all that.
Goofy
pirate gangs with Brutus. They're kind of, I think they're supposed to be a little bit of, there's a little Fleischer in the animation there, in the character choices. You get a little bit of Popeye from these guys. Mm-hmm. And then this concept that the kidnapped girls are having the time of their life is just a great way to open a movie. It's so much fun. And that these pirates are never, they're not really that dangerous in any way. I don't know. It's such a great sequence and it's visually fantastic, but when they get in that canal, it's like, wow, he really stepped it up there. And there's where you start to see his innovations and him getting better as an animator and with thoughts of, you know, action, kinetic action that we then get perfected with Princess Mononoke. But this is so much fun. There's so many different sequences of this movie. And is this the funniest Miyazaki movie? I think maybe. I'm trying to think of another movie that gets as many laughs as this one, like true laughs.
I think that's probably true. I think so. I mean, Kiki's is quite cute, obviously, and there's a few chuckles around this, I guess. But yeah, I think you're right. And just, you know, on that kind of canal sequence, I would widen it and say that the whole kind of Milan piece, because the rest of it is all kind of on the sea and on the Adriatic coast, but to take you out and put you in Milan and introduce kind of, you know, some spies and things like that, and, you know, and the rebuild of the plane by the women of the village of the town, I just love being taken out and then taken back. It adds a fantastic dimension to the movie, I think.
Yeah.
I also really love the sequence where he's telling Theo his story about World War I, and you see all the like ghost pilots. That sequence is really moving to me. So
beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to mention it's the funniest line in any Miyazaki movie. It's got to be when the Texan pilot walks in the room and spews out this like flowery prose and then just says, "That's my favorite line from a screenplay I wrote." I don't know why that this line just drops me on the floor.
That is a great line.
He's from Alabama in the Japanese original.
But he's texting in the Disney and voiced by Cary Elwes. That old you know that old Texan Cary Elwes.
Yes. Like, questionable choice.
Like I don't think he's from Texas. I think, but you know what? It's endearing. Sometimes, Neil, you have the problems with the casting here and there. I get it. When I'm listening to them speak, I'm like, this isn't quite right. But there's also something endearing about the miscasting sometimes. And maybe that's because when you watch these movies five or six times, dubbed in English, it just grows on you, and you come to love it. Because I think he's funny in that role. I think it's good casting in a way.
Yeah,
at the end,
a comedic
it's
role,
it's
right?
baffling.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and you know the pirate, the lead pirate, right? The Brutus character. He's played by Ray Romano's brother in Everyone
Loves Raymond.
Brett Garrett. Yeah, and I think that is my favorite piece of the voice casting because I think he's great.
No, he's fantastic. Yeah, he's great. He's got that super deep voice and is a truly funny man. So it really comes through with his line delivery. Speaking of deliveries, we should move on to our fourth film.
I love these segues.
I was going to say, which is going to be? Are we going up or back? What direction are we heading?
We are
going
to go back, folks. Those of you who are waiting for us to talk about Howl's Moving Castle, we might talk about it a little bit, but we're going to dive deeper into Kiki's Delivery Service. I've forgotten the year it came out.
That was in 89.
Come along on a ride you'll never forget with an all-new feature-length movie adventure.
Go!
Coming to video for the very first time.
Hold on!
Kiki's Delivery Service. It's a journey of friendship and courage. With Kiki, a witch in training who's just getting the hang of flying.
Hold on there, son!
It's the story of Kiki's quest for independence.
Feel the wind
and all her extraordinary adventures.
She got it! She saved the youngster!
Featuring Kirsten Dunst as Kiki and Matthew Lawrence as Tombo. Delivery Service, coming this summer only on video.
I got so excited by this movie watching it for the first time a couple of days ago. I was just absolutely enthralled with it and didn't know where it was going, but never felt lost. But it made these weird choices of, and it was defining this idea of the society of witches as their version of this, because it didn't look like any witch movie I've ever seen before, and yet it did these incredible things. The aerodynamic stuff also was like made this weird kind of sense for how brooms work in the air, which I thought was really wonderful, that it indicates that he took that time to try to think that stuff through. But that was the suspense engine thing I was mentioning earlier, is that there's a moment where there's the business with the dog Jeff, and we can all see the cliches that could turn into and how long it was going to take to accomplish the final goal. And instead, he doesn't do that at all. Jeff just comes out and hands it over, and you're so grateful that it didn't waste your time with some shenanigans, and we can keep the story moving. And that was what I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, I love this movie. I think it's a great coming of age story.
Yeah.
And it really is.
He does not shy away at all from the difficult moments that Kiki has, and that I think is the real master element of this movie. You know, Kiki goes through a depression in this movie, and he doesn't shy away from it. He teaches you how she gets out of that, and by seeking help from Ursula. And from her kind of surrogate mother, I guess, in the bakery, this is a real thing that happens to kids that is often just not depicted in movies, or I guess especially in And Disney would, I don't think, would ever dream of going anywhere near something like this. But he doesn't.
Well, even, and I would argue the relationship with Ursula is pretty complex, mm-hmm. and even to the point where some guy goes, "Hey, you look like a boy," or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, okay, so
yep.
okay, what exactly what is are we dealing with here? And I thought that again gives it an air of maturity and ambiguity that really was welcome. Mm-hmm.
I got to say, as a parent, the first 5-10 minutes of this movie give me anxiety. There's something about the fact that she so casually is just going to leave home yep. forever, without any warning to her parents. It really does. When he's out there, when the dad's out there tying up the camping equipment on the car, they were planning on doing something else. She's like, "Hey, Dad, forget about that. I'm just going to leave home forever now." I'm always like, "How could anyone do that?"
Bringing it forward a month.
Yeah,
God, I hope that doesn't happen to me. It's interesting. The casual, like leaving home forever.
But he doesn't feel a need. Miyazaki doesn't feel a need to explain, you know, why that's happening. He just mm-hmm. tells you this is how it is in this world. This is what they do.
It's how witches go. Yep.
That's how it is with witches. And I guess they know that. You know, the mom being a witch, they know. Mm-hmm. They know that's how it goes. So they were expecting it to a certain extent.
And the journey that she goes on, that we're invited to go with her, is one where we're on a very equal plane with her. It's not like with Spirited Away, where, as you said, you know, she's a brat at the beginning and we kind of have to watch her. Like, we're really with Kiki on this mm-hmm. on this journey, and we share all of her disappointments and surprises. The conflicts come from places that we wouldn't expect. Sometimes they're situational, sometimes they're character, but never in the order that we would expect that to happen. And so I just really was taken by this. I did hear, so the cat, is it true that the Japanese version, the cat's female versus the American version where it's Phil Hartman, I think, doing the voice?
Well, it's voiced by Rei Sakuma, who is a female actress, a female actor, so yeah. But I think the character of Gigi is a male cat.
Because he falls in love with the lady cat.
They have babies, and I think that's the only way that works.
So, yeah.
I wrote a story years ago about, it was set in Japan, and it was about a fox familiar. And there's this tradition of animal familiars in Japan, and I believe they are specifically gendered in voice, despite the gender of the animal itself. So a cat is a female voice, period, no matter whether the cat is male or female. And a dog, I think that comes up with Princess Mononoke. Dogs are specifically male-gendered voices, despite their gender. And that was a little bit, I think that was a little bit, with Gillian Anderson, that was controversial. I don't know if controversial is maybe too strong a word, but it was seen as a weird choice, at least.
Well, I have to say, I do not like Phil Hartman as the voice of Gigi.
Oh, no.
No,
I love Phil Hartman.
I'm sorry.
I love him so much.
I'm sorry. It just takes me out. It's a bit too much for me.
It's definitely surprising.
I think it's fantastic.
Is that because you recognize Phil Hartman's voice, or is it because it's just the general performance? If you didn't know Phil Hartman, you'd still have the same reaction.
I think it's the latter. I think it just kind of hams it up a bit too much for me. Just over-eggs it a bit.
Yeah, I actually don't think I've seen anything else that Phil Hartman is in, so I didn't know it was Phil Hartman. I know who he is, but I wouldn't have recognized that. It was just such a surprising voice acting choice.
Jamie, you've never seen Jingle All the Way?
I don't think I have.
Okay.
No.
I'm surprised.
I know I know he was on News Radio, which I'm mm-hmm. a little too young for, and he did stuff on The Simpsons, which my parents didn't let me watch. So.
Lots of Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, of course, for many years,
and Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, he unfortunately actually passed away during the dubbing sessions, I believe, of this.
This is his last.
I knew it was his last thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that he might have finished. He might have finished his, but it was during this. They still hadn't completed the production for the English dub version yet when he was murdered.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, bringing the room down. Sorry about that.
Yeah, thanks, John.
But Sakuma-san, so if you watch the Japanese language original, Sakuma-san does, I think, a beautiful job of Gigi's voice. It's kind of, it's more smoothly sarcastic. Because Gigi's a sarcastic character, and that's what I love about Gigi the character. But she just brings this kind of smoothness to it that that is worth it. It's worth watching, I think, just for that.
What else can we add to this?
Well, Mitch, you had mentioned something earlier about the suspense engine.
Oh, well, that was the thing I was saying about with the dog, with just the fact that it doesn't get ratcheted up in a way that
gotcha.
You wouldn't expect it. But we also mentioned the lack of music in the climax. And the climax is so great because she does ultimately emerge as the hero and does an heroic action in the end and saves him, which I just thought was really great.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me about this movie is the and we could talk about this a little bit in like the entire catalog of Studio Ghibli films, actually. But the ratcheting up of stakes in this movie is almost kind of funny in a way, because right. The first bit of stake raising at all is a baby might cry. that's the crisis. That baby might cry if it wakes up.
That is a crisis in Spirited Away.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. In this case, it's like, well, that could still happen anyway. It's like, when you think about the what's set up with that with the pacifier, it's kind of humorous to me. Mm-hmm. But as the movie goes along, her emotional stakes are high, of course, but the external stakes, you finally get to the point where we have like an almost upside down dirigible, like in the air.
Right.
Like, wow, this really escalated, right. didn't it?
Her other stakes are like delivering a fish pie to a party.
Right, it's great though. Or losing the toy was pretty big.
Yeah,
that always gives me like a little gasp.
But not dirigible crashing on your town, big.
Right, not that big. Yeah.
All of which are bigger and more interesting than a boy girl thing.
Yes,
which is another thing that I really love about this is that he. Steers you very quickly into thinking, oh, this is going to, oh, she's going to be about her, and will she get the boy? And then that sort of gets thrown away and becomes way more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that kind of, that's something I noticed through all of this last watch of these four, is that he really doesn't fall into that cliche of trying to set up this romance plot as the primary thing for his mm-hmm. female protagonists. And it's really welcome and wonderful, and Spielberg doesn't have that bone in his body where he can steer away from that kind of sentimental junk, you know.
Yeah, now you got me thinking. Now I feel like he finally came around in Ready Player One, but then again, that's
oh come on! I mean, I was just watching that movie, and it's like the girl that he's in love with who has the terrible disfigurement.
Oh, I was thinking of it from the girl's point of view.
I'm gonna put Jurassic Park in the running. There's a very subtle romance that is already established. Neil knows it's my favorite movie of all time, but there's not really a love story that happens in Jurassic Park except between the audience and Ian Malcolm. So,
yeah, right. that's Yeah, I know. I mean, it's great. Ian Malcolm's putting the moves, you know, on Laura Dern, and it's funny.
Yeah,
she's not remotely interested in him. It's so there's a lot of little just Laura Dern facial beats in that movie that are hilarious. Just her response to his attempts, are always funny.
But it does not make what's his name uncomfortable though. Alan Grant.
Yeah.
He's a little uncomfortable with it all, isn't he? And I like that.
Yeah, he's worried he might be out of his league. Yeah. You know, with Ian Malcolm.
You know, we talk about the ending. There's one very big difference that Miyazaki was upset about with the Disney dub on this one. This is the first Disney dub they did, I think. Once they got hold of the deal, or it might have been that. Maybe it was the earliest
of
the movies. I can't. It was either the earlier of the movies, because there was an original English dub done by Streamline Pictures in 1990, but Disney got hold of this one in 1997, 98 and did the dub.
Okay.
The And they made a key change at the end. So right at the end, when Gigi climbs on Kiki's shoulders when they're in the crowd, he doesn't say anything in the Japanese original. He's silent. And you have more ambiguity. Has he lost his voice for good? Has he moved? Have they transitioned mm-hmm. to that kind of new stage of their relationship, Gigi and Kiki, where she can't hear him talk anymore? So you don't know. But in the Disney dub, you get a big Phil Hartman meow. You know, it's not a cat's meow. It's Phil Hartman saying the word meow. And I just think it spoils her character arc a little. She's been through a tough time. Through her own kind of reflection, and with the help of some of her, close friends, she's kind of come out of it a stronger and more mature person with life experience. It's like she's grown up as a result of her relationship with Gigi, and that which has changed. Gigi no longer talking carries that kind of through for me. But having his humanized voice come back just sort of takes that growth away a little bit.
And that's really interesting. That's the difference between Walt Disney and corporate Disney, because I will bet you that if Walt Disney were supervising this, it would be more like the Miyazaki ending. Because you think about the ending of the two versions of The Jungle Book, the Walt Disney version, he has to leave the jungle, that's part of growing up, and he doesn't get to come back, and Bagheera and Baloo are sad. And then in the new corporate version of The Jungle Book, none of that. He's coming back into the jungle.
Wow, I did not know there were two endings to that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I can barely remember. Was that the Favreau? Did Favreau do that?
Yeah, the Jungle John Favreau version doesn't have that bittersweet. It's the last line in the book by Kipling.
Right.
It's like, and now I will go to man.
Yes.
Mm. Would they have done the same with Mononoke, do you think? They would have
gotten married at the end or something.
She would have moved to the village and left the cub, the wolf cubs.
Probably. Mm. Sadly, I'm afraid that's where we are with the modern Disney.
Mm.
Though I don't like the ending of Real Mononoke anyway, where Ashitaka is like, both sides have great points. I'm going to straddle the middle for the rest of time.
that's typical him, though, isn't it? He just doesn't want to upset anyone.
He's a real politician.
Yeah, that's, again, another annoying aspect of the character for me.
Yeah. So maybe it's true to his character.
That's fair. Just,
I think
we just don't like it.
Well, he's
not coming to my party.
Right.
So are we considering Kiki as a truly great? I kind of think so.
Yeah. I was stunned by it. Yeah. I had such an I would think it's, and also it adds into this question of the amazing range of these four movies, right? How tonally different, yet they're all by the same person and they feel by the same person, but they're all so different in terms of setting and themes and what they're up to. We can plunk two more movies into this list of four, right? And that even further demonstrates this.
We could have easily, to limit ourselves to the four, we could have easily started with Totoro and ended with Mononoke, but there's no way I would have wanted to leave Spirited Away out of this. And some people feel differently, and I think the more controversial film that I think still fits is Howl's Moving Castle, which is one that I adore, but some people maybe on this podcast at this moment don't think it's as great as some of the other movies. I never get tired. That was an Archer favorite. When he was like four years old, we'd watch it every week. It was like every week for a month or two, we watched Howl's Moving Castle, or The Moving Castle, as it was called then.
Right.
And I never got tired of it. I don't know. So
after you said that to me, I thought about it, and I think the problem for me is that Howl is such an annoying love interest for Sophie. Like that guy is so high maintenance. Like Sophie needs better. You know,
she can do better. Yeah,
she can do better.
I don't disagree with that at all. But that's interesting. I mean,
that was my daughter's reaction to the movie when we watched it the first time.
Yeah.
Like, oh my god.
They love Howl.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're like this guy.
This guy.
They love him.
I'll give you a
We like boy bands. We just don't know whether we want to date them.
I mean, yeah. We also talked about this on Science and Magic, but the androgyny of Miyazaki young male leads is hilarious to
Haku.
Me.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely thought Haku was a girl for like 3 minutes in Spirited Away.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Which I guess is just like a Japanese animation thing in general, but
I think that's right. I think
Howl
right.
is very beautiful, but seems like he'd be really annoying to date.
Oh, for sure.
what's the boy's name in Kiki? It just
Tombo.
Tombo.
So Tombo is
poor Tombo.
Poor Tombo, but Tombo's rear end is presented throughout right. in a couple of arguably erotic shots. It's pretty weird. You know?
Yeah, but Ursula is like inducting Kiki into like forest lesbian cottagecore life. So
mm-hmm. right.
yeah. totally. Yeah, no, she wins, yeah. no doubt. She's the winner. But yeah.
I want to give a really, really base level explanation for why I love Kiki, or not Kiki, but Howl's Moving Castle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is just the simple, everybody's holed up in a cozy space movie.
Mm.
There's something about this castle and this space that's just, as soon as it's entered, it's like, this is a wonderful, cozy space for all these people to inhabit. And then, as of course, when it gets cleaned up, it's very satisfying. There's something about living in the movie to me that makes it so enjoyable. And then, of course, the concept of you can be in this one place. It's almost like you're in a cabin in the middle of the woods or something. You're like completely isolated from the rest of the world in this thing. And yet you could just turn a dial, open a door, and be anywhere else mm-hmm. at the same time. That it's just a wonderful journey to me. You're not wrong at all about the character of Howl. I mean, I'm no Howl lover. And honestly, the Christian Bale, the dubbing on it doesn't help.
No,
I think he does a bad job. No. It's just something about his voice coming through that's like, yeah, this guy really does strike you as a bit of a diva character. But I love Billy Crystal as Calcifer. I bet Neil doesn't.
No, I do. He's actually...
You do? Oh,
I'm going to surprise you. I really love him. I think he's fantastic. I really do. And
two of my favorite people... Oh, sorry, Neil, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, I was going to confess to you guys that this is possibly the only one where I actually prefer the Disney dub.
Oh, okay.
Oh, all right. Okay. That's interesting.
Mainly because of him. But also, I mean, it's a wonderful cast. If you take a look at who's performing here, you know, you've got Lauren Bacall, you've got Gene Simmons. I mean, these are just wonderful actresses, and the voice yeah. Gene Simmons doing the old Sophies, I think, is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was going to say two of my favorite people have a naughty cat that they named Calcifer. And we play Dungeons and Dragons over Zoom a lot, and the whole time they're just like, Calcifer, no! Calcifer, get off that! Calcifer, Calcifer!
My cat is also named Calcifer.
Oh, really?
Fantastic.
No, I'm just kidding. I was doing the line from The Simpsons. Where it's the Bort line.
So, John, you said that cozy space, it made me think of this question of... I think everybody could pick one Miyazaki movie that they'd like to live in as far as the environment. But my question is there another filmmaker whose world you're just like, whenever you see their movie, you're like, yeah, I just want to live in that.
I just want to live in that.
A friend of mine used to say that about Alan Rudolph movies. Like, I just want to live inside of an Alan Rudolph interesting. Movie. Everybody's kind of hazy, and stoned, and there's great music.
That's a good question. I mean, I've certainly thought about movies that way. I like to be in I just like to be in Twin Peaks. I just love being in Twin
Good
Peaks.
God.
And what part of Twin Peaks?
Yeah.
I would be a little scared to go to Sheriff Truman says, I'd be a little scared to go to sleep. But, but yet, that Northwestern, the setting, everything, I just like to be there and eating pie and drinking coffee at the diner. Come on, that would be amazing.
I watched recently Our Man in Havana, and I just love it when they're having their little cocktails in that bar, in the open-air bar, the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
So apart from kind of, the impending threat, and, you know, if I think about Casablanca as well, obviously apart from the times, looking back to kind of movies like that are set kind of back, you know, 100 years ago or around then, out in an exotic location like that. That's mine.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. I'm going to want rain or snow. I'm going to want, you know, lots of trees, greenery, things like that. As soon as you said Our Man in Havana, I'm like, too dusty and hot. Thanks.
High wind in Jamaica before the house breaks down.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's I'd kind of like to live there.
Except that looks like Swiss Family Robinson to me or something. You know, it's kind of like
it does.
That.
It's true.
A little bit Technicolor Disneyfied island kind of thing.
I'd live in what is it? The James Bond first Daniel Craig one. Casino Royale.
Casino Royale.
Yeah, literally any setting in that movie, I would be happy to inhabit.
That's true.
With
That's true.
A like American Express fancy card of some kind.
That's great.
We should though, you know, getting back to the Miyazaki, we should talk about My Neighbor Totoro because My Neighbor Totoro predates. Wait, it's yeah. right before Kiki. Yeah,
it's right.
I was
before
just thinking
Kiki,
that yeah. Castle in the Sky is before Totoro.
Yeah,
we should tell you that. Yeah, I bet you're about to say the same thing I'm about to say, Neil.
What's that?
It was released as a double feature with Grave of the Fireflies.
Right. Okay, that's... Wait, did you guys tell me that? I can't remember where I just heard that.
Maybe.
I think maybe.
I think it's a hilarious fact, because I can't imagine
be
like a bigger buzzkill.
Yes,
so.
Neil did mention
both
it.
Both of
nice.
Them. Wait, would they both be buzzkills? Is I haven't seen Totoro. I can't remember.
No, Totoro's the opposite
no,
of
Totoro
a
buzz.
It's not
this
sad, right? It's happy.
Whimsical, right. happy good world.
Totoro gets sad, but it... You know, that's the that's cathartic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Grave of the Fireflies is devastating.
That's what I hear. I'm afraid.
I remember now that for the listeners that don't know, which you wouldn't probably, but Neil and Jamie and I are all in the same like Facebook message group and we talk a lot. And I think, Neil, you did mention this on that group last week, maybe. And I said, please tell me Totoro was the second feature.
That's right. You did say that.
Well,
please tell me they didn't. You don't start with Totoro and then go to Grave of the Fireflies.
They completely left it up to the individual theater.
Oh, no. Oh, wow.
So who knows which one you were going to get first?
You cannot show Grave of the Fireflies after
Is it,
Totoro.
You're too browbeaten after that movie for anything?
It's well.
Go outside
I mean,
and lie down on the ground.
The palate cleanser that would be Totoro. It's like, grateful. You see a small child slowly die. You want to see some children then, like, learning and loving life. You know, not the other way around, please.
I'll tell you, Mitch. I mean, Grave of the Fireflies. You know, we give each of these movies a school grade, right? Towards the end of our episodes, and that one. We only just finished recording Spirited Away yesterday, and it was only Spirited Away that beat Grave of the Fireflies in grades. Grave of the Fireflies got straight A's.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is a great film. There's no doubt about it. It just hurts. It's the come and see of animation, Mitch. Have you seen Grave of the Fireflies? I'm sorry.
I haven't. I'm really excited. I want to watch that, and I haven't.
I have it. I can loan it to. Oh no, it's on HBO. Never mind.
It is. Yeah.
So I've got lots of cool stuff to watch.
It is the one that occasionally a couple times Archer has found it on the shelf, the Blu-ray, and I've had to say,
not yet,
not yet, buddy. Yeah. We're gonna have to wait till you're in high school for that one at least.
Yeah.
I think that's why I don't like Totoro as much is because the stakes on Totoro are like so low. Like it's like, oh, the mom's sick, but now she's better. It's fine.
Yeah, but that journey when the mom's sick and the girl disappears is pretty, I don't know. It's pretty harrowing to me. But there's just this lovely, there's something about low stakes children's programming. It's a straight up kids movie.
Yeah, it is.
That happens to allow itself to get dark enough that it has real emotional stakes. But there's something about that it's, hey, kids find a creature. This kid's having trouble adjusting. She finds a creature in the woods that helps her understand what life is about. And just, it jumps up in the air and plants grow. And there's a bus made out of a cat. Like, to me, that's just enough. And I'm another one that we've watched. I mean, I think Archer's seen that movie a dozen times. He shows it to people. His mom came over to watch it. I'm going to show you Totoro. Come watch Totoro. So it's like, man, it's a movie that means a lot to me, and I certainly think it's on the same level. I mean, I like it better than Kiki. I love Kiki, but I like it better than Kiki, you know? So if there's going to be, for the quadfecta, if there's a straight line, if we have to have this perfectly straight line, I think we kind of dip down with Kiki just a slight bit. But I don't know, man. Totoro, I've heard many, many, many people say they're absolutely their favorite, Miyazaki, and... Why am I even asking?
You our guest for that episode.
Like that. Yeah.
Our guest for that episode gave it an A+ and was extremely into it. And he has a little daughter who I think is about the same age as Archer. So maybe that helps.
I mean, we have a Totoro in the living room, you know, like that guy, yeah. that guy mm-hmm. with a, and a Kodama. There's a Kodama and a Totoro. They hang out with each other all the time.
On my fireplace right behind me.
Oh, there yeah. he is.
Look at that.
Bought from the Ghibli Museum in Tokyo.
Oh.
If you ever go to Tokyo, you have to go to the Ghibli Museum. It's unbelievably wonderful.
Yeah, it's a plan. I really want to do that.
Totoro, for me, is it's really just about, I mean, not just about, I mean, for me, the best thing about Totoro is how much he throws big things at you. Like, Totoro's big, right? When I say big thing, I mean, like, physically big things. Like, Totoro's big. He could be, I guess, a little scary. His claws, you know, when he scratches his butt at the bus stop, you see his claws. And then the cat bus. I mean, it's just, the cat bus itself is just an unforgettable moment in cinema, I think, when it turns up and it's just a massive wow moment. I mean, maybe it's the biggest wow moment of any of Miyazaki's movies. I love the cat bus.
It's funny, Neil, very early in the episode you asked, you know, do we think Miyazaki is a great composer of shots, or however mm-hmm. you put it, and I think that in this movie in particular you could point out that the imagery you see from the iconic imagery you see from Totoro, the marketing imagery they use, is never just some marketed graphic design version of it's almost mm-hmm. always a shot from the movie that you're seeing. I've seen many a Totoro tattoo, and it's always him at the bus stop.
Right.
It's not, oh, here's Totoro in some pose that you might see on a trading card or something.
Yeah.
It's always the shot from the movie, and I think that this is a great example of him knowing how to compose, like making a painting out of a moment.
Mm. Totoro yeah. is really beautiful. That's the house I would live in all the Miyazaki yeah. films. I love that house.
Yeah.
And a lot of the landscape is just, like, so gorgeous.
Okay, then what's your choice of transportation from Miyazaki? The water train, the cat bus, or Porco's plane?
Porco's, I gotta go.
Porco's plane. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
For sure.
Though I do like the water train.
If I could get inside a cat, I'm getting inside a cat. I'm sorry.
That's, well, if I could,
if and it's not the, like the what it really
smell
would
very
be
good.
The inside.
If you go to the museum, you can go in because there's a life-size plush cat bus that they let the kids run around.
Oh,
I picture you coming out like coughing up a furball.
But you know that bus stop scene is quite an iconic one of his, isn't it? Across all of his movies, and you know if you kind of look at that scene. You know, it's so much more to it than just a cat bus arriving. It's it starts with the girls arriving, then you've got Totoro, the rain arriving, the Totoro arriving, the beautiful umbrella exchange. But then he gets you. He doesn't just bring the cat bus on you. He brings there's a guy on a bicycle just cycles past. So you see the light, mm-hmm. and it's just hit the cycle. The cyclist goes past, and then the real bus arrives, but Dad's not there. And of course then the cat bus arrives, off Totoro goes, and then Dad arrives on the bus. So that whole sequence is just masterfully kind of paced, and just one thing after another. It's like, what's next?
And it's done, you know, it's, if I recall, it's done pretty quietly too with no music. I think you're just kind of getting rainfall sound, soundscape from the rainfall. And thinking about my kid watching this movie so many times, you would think that sequence could be tedious to a child, yet it's not, because it's so perfectly put together, tight as a drum. There's actual suspense to it for something that seems so simple. It's just beautiful filmmaking, and I mean, he's a master. That's one of the things I wanted to ask, you know, maybe this could be our closing question. I think that quadfecta accomplished. I think we've established that as far as the game goes. But Miyazaki, he's the master of animation, right? We're talking all time. When we take in, you know, we think about our masters of cinema, your Hitchcocks, John Fords, Kurosawas, Kubricks, so on. This guy's, he's number one, right? Is there anyone else, as far as the topic in the context of auteurism? There's nobody else, right?
I mean, what about Walt Disney?
But that's the difference, is that Walt Disney didn't even... I mean, even early on, he wasn't really doing the artwork.
Fair enough.
He's all Disney. Now, you could definitely argue that Disney, Mitch and I were talking about it a little bit, and Mitch said, you know, he created a very consistent product under his, but he was an overseer mostly. And yes, he instructed, he set the standards, you know, for the style of animation and for the, I mean, the, all the work that went into making those films. But so did Miyazaki, right? And yet Miyazaki, we've all seen, I assume, we've all seen him sitting at that table drawing cells,
yeah,
handing them to that young lady who thinks he's hilarious. I always love that in the, I'd see the documentary a couple of times. He's always making her laugh through the whole day. And all her entire job is sitting at a table waiting for him to finish drawings.
I mean, you're right.
There's Don, you have your Don Bluth, you have your Ralph Bakshi, but none of them quite touch Miyazaki. I don't know. I just wanted to throw that out there as a discussion topic to close out on.
I mean, I don't
anybody comes close.
I don't think those guys get anywhere near what Miyazaki's accomplished over his career. And I think, you know, he's made 10 movies. Well, he's directed 10 movies. He wrote a couple more of them that he gave to the directors, like Whisper of the Heart and The Cat Returns. Those were his work, and Dario Eddy, he wrote. But if you look at the ones that he directed, they're 10 fantastic movies. I mean, The Wind Rises, his last one, is I think a little indulgent. It's, you know, his father was a maker of aircraft parts. This is where his fascination, his love of aircraft comes from. This is really kind of his, you know, and you know, he came out of retirement again. You know, the first time he came out of retirement was to make Princess Mononoke, and I think he's come out of retirement to make every single one since. Right. So thankfully, because I never want him to retire. But The Wind Rises, I think for me, is the most indulgent, and so maybe the loosest. But I mean, it's still a high bar would be for any other movie maker. And he's making another one. He's making How Do You Live, which is a TBA in the release date. We don't even have a year for that to come out. But I don't think anyone comes close to these 10 movies.
Yeah.
I just went back and looked at Don Bluth. He's pretty good too. I don't think he's at the same level, but these are like my childhood favorites over here.
Sure.
Like which?
Bluth.
Oh, American Tail was...
All right.
The ultimate for me, because when I was a little kid, my family moved to Canada, so I was an immigrant too. Oh. And then like Land Before Time, All Dogs Go to Heaven, Anastasia, just great movies.
Great movies, but, yeah.
Yeah, not at the same level, but still pretty great.
Secret of Nim, big memory. I saw that with my grandma. She had to be like, what happened to cartoons?
Right. That was scary. That's
quite a scary one, right?
That's a really scary movie.
Right.
With dark, the stakes are really bleak.
Yep.
In that, you know, what's going on in that movie. But he drove too hard for the commercial for my taste. Not that I don't like the movies, but, I mean, American Tail, guess who's the executive producer of An American Tail? Our old friend Steven Spielberg. He's definitely driving at this, like, hit-making, there was a hit-making idea behind his work.
And Land Before Time was Spielberg, I think, too.
Yeah, I think, I think that Bluth, they had a partnership there for quite a while. You're seeing kind of he's a hit-maker. Miyazaki's not a hit-maker, even though he has made hits. That's... You don't ever get the idea that's what he's going into it for. So, we don't have to. I think the guy that would have done it had he maybe been younger and started in the cell animation era would have been Brad Bird. I think he had had a great chance if he had made, three or four more movies at the same level as the Iron Giant in traditional animation. I have a really hard time giving. I think The Incredibles is a fantastic movie. I just have a little bit of a harder time giving it to someone that's working in computer animation. I don't mean to be. I love Pixar movies.
Lasseter comes in the same bucket.
Yeah. And then is how creative of a force was Lasseter? I don't even know. He just feels like more of a producer and not. Anyway,
yeah. I just
we don't
learned
talk
that
about him anyway.
That Brad Bird is the voice of the monorail announcer on Jurassic World, in addition to his other work.
I thought he was the voice of. Why did I think he was the voice of the day at DNA for some reason?
I don't know.
He did a voice for. I knew he did a voice had something to do with the animation for DNA, right?
Oh, interesting. He is not. That's not listed on his Wikipedia.
Okay, then I'm just way off.
Yeah,
I must have mixed up what I'd heard. But you know, he did The Simpsons for a long time too. But Man, had Iron Giant, say, come out in the 70s, and he would have had the 80s to work with off of that, I think Brad Bird could have started touching it. But
maybe if Matt Groening had made movies instead of, you know, big sprawling series, maybe he would have made a few good ones like the, like, I mean, I love Futurama, I think, is underrated. It's a great series.
It's great.
Yeah.
But the artwork is not so, like, sweeping and...
Not quite.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a lot of contention in the Simpsons world as to how much of a contribution he really made to any of it anyway. Mm. But that's getting into a whole other podcast that maybe he gets a little more credit than he deserves on the whole thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, well, we could close out on that then, I guess. Bashing Matt Groening is the note we're going out on. Anyway, well, Neil, Jamie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
It's great to talk
to you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for having us. It's been a real treat, a real a real pleasure.
We look forward to Science and Magic.
Yeah, really looking forward to it.
Thank you. A couple more months of editing.
Yes, summer 2021.
Yes.
There we go.
We are also podcast auteurs, so we need to perfect our product.
Right, exactly.
Is there a social media presence? Anything we should be, or where we can find you? Or
we're kind of working
not
on
yet.
That too. Yeah, there will be.
We'll pass it along when we have it.
Thank you.
All right, absolutely. We'll make sure all of our listeners know.
Thank you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Quadfecta. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.